really simple. There's no magic in it. It's just how to implement it. Of course, you would be doing it contained in the laboratory. You wouldn't be bringing a broadcast into this. So that's why you need money, because you have to generate the signal. You're going to have to get either modify somebody's multiplexer or have them custom make you one where you can drive the clocks externally. Things of that nature, but yeah, we could do it.
One of the best brags that I can make in the last 10 years is that I've discovered a kind of antenna concept, UHF antenna, with wide elements, without using computer modeling, because computer modeling cannot give you the answer. But doing ham radio tinkering in front of a well-calibrated vector network analyzer, I have found a whole class of antennas that have got a huge standing wave ratio advantage. You know, 1.05 to 1 standing wave ratio, maximum, of course, a 3% bandwidth, 902 to 928 megs. And I filed a bunch of patents on that. It's real. Okay, and the first question I asked myself, how the hell, after 100 years of antenna science, no one's discovered that up till now? How have they missed it all this time? So, occasionally, the smart guys miss damn good information. Let me drop. Assuming that there really is this advantage in ATSC television demodulation with proper timing, let's call it the high spectral purity local smart timing, let's call it smart timing. If there is that advantage, how have the smart guys, after all of this ATSC experience, missed it, if it's really there? And if we're right, and if it's really there and they've missed it, and sometimes that happens, it's time we convince the guy. With the guys with the power to jump on this bandwagon and start getting this advantage. Yeah, it's going to take a couple of years for somebody to come up with a chip that does it all at a reasonable price. But the longest journey begins with the first step. Let's start taking that first step. K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I hear you, Dick. Don't forget that we might be possibly throwing this system out the window. So, I don't know how business-wise it's going to be looked at. I see your point of view. I understand it. It makes perfect sense. But will it make perfect sense to the people who have tested their system in the laboratory and created all the multipath and stuff like that and said, oh, yeah, stuff works? How do you change their brains?
Dick, I have a comment for you.
Whenever you program whenever you propose something new, human nature, if you have knowledge of it, predicts you're going to get pushed back at first. It's called the NIH problem, not invented here. The idea can't be a good idea because I didn't think of it, is the attitude. You're going to get pushed back at first. Let's see what Joe's got to suggest on this one. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Look what trouble you got us into, Joe. K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, I'm going to make a comment on your picture going away. Your picture going away may be due to an external RF emitter or emitters, and you know what I'm talking about, that are overloading your converter, because these things do not like outer band stuff that's very high in level coming in down the antenna. And if they see that momentarily, they'll just not decode a picture.
Some of the time you're right, Joe. I have a way of knowing when those strong signals that you're talking about are present. I have a way of knowing when they're absolutely not present. And so the grief that I get where various channels of mine disappear, 75% of the time, 80% of the time, it is not an extraneous strong signal. There's something going on with the multipath inter-symbol distortion, I believe, that the Duke's Hills water tower is a third of a mile from my house. And so every so often I'm guessing that the super refraction, in other words, Mother Nature's humidity versus altitude index of the 30 miles between me and Empire State Building changes so that the amount of echo I get off of that water tower changes in phase, amplitude, and whatever from day to day. That's a possible place where I'm getting multipath from. It's just far enough away that it gives enough delay that the inter-symbol distortion could be the peaks of one symbol hits the valley of another symbol, and the system can't tolerate that. So from time to time, I have reason to believe it's not strong local signals, although I'm not positive about that. There is a source of strong local signals close to my house, and the majority of them are pretty far away, miles away. I'm having trouble believing that something miles away on the right frequency could be giving me front-end overload. Over to you, Joe, to B2LYY, K2IW.
Okay, so maybe it's not coming from your property. Maybe it's coming from that other transmitting site that's near you. That possibility, I don't know. But here's something else to think about, and here's a question you can answer directly. Is your television antenna above the tree line or below the tree line? Because if it's below, it may consistently have a signal being, you know, changing because of your branches moving, things like that. And where some days it's good, some days it's not so good. And it may be an intermittent type of thing. A branch moves a certain way, and you get a certain amount of multipath on a certain RF frequency, and you lose lock.
Yeah, I've made some antenna changes, and temporarily the antenna is below the tree line. I don't like that. But and a solution is on the way. That's going to be changed. That antenna is about to go back on the tower. It's going to get some altitude. I hope I'm going to get some significant improvement when I do that. But you're right on that one, Joe. That's definitely an aggravating factor. However, the solution that Eric and I are talking about has to work for the general person that puts an aerial on the chimney of the house. If the only way that the system Eric and I are talking about only works and you put it at the 75-foot level of a radio tower, yeah, there are affluent people out there. Very few of them have got that much enthusiasm. Only a ham radio operator would do that. So Joe and I mean Eric and I are looking for a solution that's going to work for the antenna below tree level. I think that's what we're looking for. Back to you on that one, Joe. W2LYY, K2IW.
I've got to throw this in. Your problem really is topography.
Do AVU a comment?
What do you mean by topography? AVU will get to you in a second. What do you mean by topography, Eric? In theory, I have almost direct line of sight to Empire. Go ahead.
Well, you've got stuff in the way. You get reflections from the stuff in the way, and it changes. And by the way, it's not the same at every frequency. It's different.
Oh, verily. I think it was AVU. Give us your full call and your name, sir, if I don't already have you. K2IW and TechNet.
Dick, this is Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Victor Uniform. Name is Tim.
Very fine, Tim. Go right ahead with your comment or question on the subject.
Hey, I've got a question for you. What kind of antenna you're using? That's the first question. And I built my own TV antenna. It's a log periodic. If you go onto my QRZ page, you're going to see that antenna. I designed that antenna, actually. And I'm picking up. I'm in Nassau, in Mineola. So I pick up. I can pick up like 68 different stations, but I do think, you know, if the wind picking up or the airplane flew by, I got a multi-pass problem. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, mine is a commercially made television aerial. I think it was Radio Shack, I'm not sure. I think it's 8-foot boom, so-called fringe area antenna. That's the good news. The bad news right now is mounted on the chimney of the house. The bad news right now, I don't have a rotator on it right now. So the first step is it needs a rotator. The second step, it needs some altitude. The antenna itself is a so-called fringe area antenna. And if the fringe area antenna had a suck out on one or two of those channels, I'd accept that. The fact that almost any one of those channels from time to time can give me grief, I don't think it's suck out of the antenna. Back to you, Tim, K2LAW.
Dick, very fine. And yeah, the antenna I built is fairly small, and you know, you can use it on transmitting on 440 and 900 meg. So you know, that was the my goal of designing this antenna. Just use this antenna as an emergency antenna, but. The antenna is in the attic right now, but I don't know what was the problem. I do notice that when we have a high wind here, I often suffer from I don't know what what it is. It could be multipass, whatever. I just thought, it's interesting. Over.
Hey, you said I should look at your website. And I, at first I thought that meant QRZ.com. No, you've got another website, which I should be looking. Oh, wait a minute, I'm looking at the wrong guy. Sorry about that, I get the wrong call letters. I'll look at your QRZ website. And I think you're saying you've got a picture of your antenna there, a homebrew antenna. And how did you decide which frequency range to emphasize it? I mean, if you're using it for over-the-air television reception, where you've got a couple of channels on lower VHF, essentially all the channels on upper VHF and almost all the channels on UHF, how did you choose which frequency range to emphasize on that antenna design, Tim? KD2AVU, K2RAW?
Dick, K2RAW, KD2AVU returning. When I designed this antenna, I looked up the band plan of the over-the-air TV, and then I decided this thing should operate, frequency range should be from 400 megahertz all the way to 900 megahertz, so I can pick up everything in between. I got the benefit that I can transmit on a ham band. So that was the design. that was the goal of design of this antenna. So, I'm more focused on the UHF portion of the HDTV. But I do pick up channel 13 from New York City. I think it's on 200 megahertz. Over.
Yeah, as I look at your QRZ.com website, I see a number of Yagi-like antennas. I see a large periodic. I see antennas that are in the attic of the house that look Yagi-like, multiple ones stacked together. I think they're on a rotator. So you favored the UHF channels. To try to make a pure Yagi-like antenna cover all of the UHF channels, that's a tall order. To cover that much frequency, I mean, a good Yagi, you can make it 3% wide, but you need more than an octave wide to cover all the UHF channels. That's not really a Yagi design anymore, if you know what I mean. The typical Yagi design, the director string is a synthesized slow wave structure with a particular velocity profile. That's not quite what you're going for here. By the way, you're an antenna designer by occupation or just a very serious tinkerer? Which is it, Tim? K2LAW?
RAW, KD2AV. It's a log periodic antenna. It's on, on my QRZ page, it's on the third picture. If you look at that antenna, that's the one I use for HDTV. The benefit of a log periodic is the wide bandwidth design. I went with that idea. Over.
Yeah, now it's clear. That third picture certainly is a log. And the good news about a log periodic, and by the way, there's many designs for log periodic, some with a very large and a very small T factor. In other words, the rate at which it tapers. You've got a so-called short taper design there, which I think is very difficult to get that with more than 7 or 8 dB over isotropic and gain. Only about 3 of the elements are really active on any one frequency. And there are log periodic designs where the taper is slower, the antenna is much longer, and you get a little bit more gain and still get all the bandwidth you want out of a log periodic. I wonder if you considered one of those, Tim. Go ahead.
Been looking at those designs, but I prefer a smaller antenna because that XYL, she's the one watching TV. I don't watch TV, for most of the time. So that's pretty much for her. And I do have a commercially made antenna, and I did a side by AB comparison, and my antenna works better. So, I don't know. But I actually plot the pattern of this antenna. I think I talked to you before. You know, just with a transmitting source into a dummy load, and I point my log periodic at the source, at the dummy load, actually. I write down the S meter numbers, and then I convert it to dBs, and into a program, Excel program, and plot the antenna pattern that way. Over.
Yeah, plotting an antenna pattern of a broadband antenna, that challenge really separates the men from the boys. It's not easy. In theory, you got to be in an environment that's got very little extraneous reflecting devices. The best one would be inside of an anechoic chamber that covers that frequency range, and that's very difficult at VHF frequencies, or on an extremely flat field, and you're using a so-called ground plane antenna range. In other words, you're calculating the effect of the ground reflection and using it in your favor, as opposed to it hurting. So measuring antenna pattern. I think you said you used a dummy load. I think by that you mean you used the leakage radiation from a dummy load as a local weak signal. And what you'll discover when you do that is that the leakage is not only coming from the dummy load, but it's also coming from the coax cable that's feeding it. So you've got a more distributed source, if that's what you did, than you think. Measuring pattern is very difficult. On top of that, let me drop it. Pattern is really a three-dimensional concept. We all talk about the E-plane or the H-plane, and we assume that all the gain is happening when you swing the antenna in azimuth only. In reality, every antenna is quasi-isotropic. It's lighting up all 41,000 square degrees on the surface of a sphere. Yeah, it's putting more signal in some directions than other, but it's putting some amount of signal in every single possible direction in space. So just measuring the 3dB beam width, for instance, gives you a necessary but not sufficient way of making an estimation, a rough estimation as to what the gain is. So that's a tough one. Joe, you've given us some damn good information tonight. Eric has contributed to it. More to follow, I'm sure. There's a lot more to know, and once his broadcast industry goes over to 3.0, let me drop. Once they go over to the 3.0 ETSC system or whatever it's going to be called, maybe they're going to make a complete change. It's quite possibly they're going to partially abandon HVSB and go over to CFBM. You know what I mean? CDFBM. Anyhow, or some combination of it. So. All these correct timings and vulnerabilities are all going to change. It's a continuing story. And so it looks like the American public is willing to pay some extra bucks to get a high-definition television. And they can't get enough of it. So they're willing to pay for it, so there's a driving force, and it's going to be a continuous evolution. As I told you guys before, let me drop it. You look at the kinescope recordings of the Milton Berle show of 1949, 1950, 1951, and you look at those recordings and you say, boy, that was a low resolution black and white fuzzy picture. How the hell did we tolerate that? Well, at the time, it's the best thing you knew about. We were happy with it, but now the cat's out of the bag. We know that there's ways of making better looking pictures, and there's people out there willing to pay for those better looking pictures. I predict there's going to be a continuous evolution. No matter what we settle on as the national standard for our method of transmitting television, no matter what that standard is, and you think it's carved in bedrock, carved in stone, not necessarily. I think that's a fairly soft stone that somebody's going to come along and remold it. Isn't that sort of true from what you see, Eric? K2EJ, if you're still there, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, you know, everybody thinks that their thing is the best thing since sliced bread, but technology moves on. But the interesting thing about the thinking with ATSC 3.0 is that we're always going to be allocated that particular space. I just went on to some stuff. I don't know if you hear me. You're always going to be locked into that 6 megahertz. And as the compression technology increases, the idea is to create an RF system that will handle that. So that way it looks towards the future and it doesn't obsolete itself.
Yeah, the amount of compression is going to increase. The amount of data, the real bits per second, is going to increase. And you're doing that by higher methods of encoding. In other words, there's more bits per symbol. And the good news of more bits per symbol is you can transmit more data if you have sufficient carrier-to-noise ratio and inter-symbol distortion control. However, any of these higher compression systems, by Shannon's law, are more vulnerable. And right now, the fact that our range has almost been halved. We used to have a significant number of people in Southampton, Long Island, watching analog over-the-air television. And now people beyond Huntington, I mean, there's an affluent community with 26,000 people that I live in this one human being watching over-the-air television. That says something pretty strong to me. So we've lost a lot of range. They're willing to tolerate that. Lucky for us, they've got cable and satellite. Otherwise, they'd really be up in arms. But, and the 3.0 system you're talking about, I'm reasonably sure it's going to work beautifully on satellite and cable. I'm guessing it's likely to be more vulnerable to over-the-air broadcast difficulty. To simultaneously give you more compression, more bits per second, in the same 6 megacycles, without more vulnerability, I think you're violating Shannon's law, if you know what I mean. I don't think we can get there. And I think you've already told me that the probability of us assigning two individual channels to one programming material, two 6 megacycle channels, is essentially out of the question, particularly because they're about to go sell some more spectrum, which I think is short-sighted. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Hello, Delta 2, Bravo Delta with a comment.
You can pick him up in a second. You know, you think like an RF guy. I'm not talking about creating more symbols. It may possibly stay at the same data rate at the RF level. I'm talking about the type of video compression would hold a higher resolution picture in the same space through various different forms of mathematics, like discrete cosine transforms and things of that nature. The methodology in which we create the picture is where the advances are. But our current system is MPEG-2, which is way out in the ancient past, actually. Okay, when you compare MPEG-2 to MPEG-4, you'll notice that the artifacts are different, but the picture that I produce with 10 megabits of MPEG-2, I can produce that same picture with 3 megabits in MPEG-4. So, look at the back end, not the front end, and then pick up the guy who wants to make a comment. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, what I think you're saying is the real smart is in the back end. And the front end modulation, other than more COFDM and less 8VSD, or the right combination of that, at the front end is not going to change as much. John, KD2BD, what do the Seagirt broadcast engineers think about all of the above? You got it, John.
K2RAW in the technical net from KD2BD. Well, I'm 45 and a half miles south of Empire, and my range didn't go down. When broadcasting went from World Trade to Empire, I started to see some snow on VHF. With the current digital standards, I have very solid reception. I have a separate Yagi that I built, 8-element Yagi that I built for NJTV reception on channel 43. When they were on analog 52, I always had snow. Now I have a very solid reception. However, that changed a couple of years ago, intermittently. I started getting breakups. Certain times of the day, other times of the day, it was fine. I went tuning around with a little scanner. I was also having this issue on channel 5 in New York, which transmits on 44. I thought there was some kind of interference on the channel RF 43 44 spectrum, so I went scanning around that with a scanner, and I couldn't find anything unusual. It took me a while to figure out that the real problem was twice the IF above those frequencies around RF channel 58, which turns out to be LTE 4G signals, and they were banging in here very strong and just blowing through the front end as an image. And so what I had to do is I had to put a quarter-wave stub in between two UHF preamps I have in the attic to notch that interference out, and since I've done that, back to a very solid reception again. K2RIW in the technical net from KD2BD.
Yeah, putting in those stubs is a good, inexpensive solution for a particular set of frequencies. But where you're getting image and real reception, it's not out of the question for you to do an image-phasing mixer. In other words, by way of using a pair of mixers with intelligence, and you know about this, you can suppress the image by another 30 dB. And I guess you can also have an RF front end that has a tracking filter to it. Maybe somebody sells a converter that does that. Or maybe even somebody sells a tunable filter where you can rotate the knob on the filter in the front end at the same time you program the system to go from channel A to channel B, so to speak. So there's solutions to that. The step solution gives you fixed frequency improvement, but some other channel at some other time might still give you some grief. And so in your case, you're fairly sure it was image reception. Let me drop this. Whether or not it's image reception in my case, I should investigate that further. But I see a lot of evidence that anybody who's doing over-the-air digital television reception picks up a significant advantage if there is a rotator on the antenna. And from day to day, they have to rotate it to a slightly different position, not to peak the signal, but to null out the multipath signal. On various days, due to weather changes, atmospheric propagation changes, that condition is continuously moving. I'll get a little bit less of that when I put the antenna higher up on the tower. This is a lot of fun. I like talking about broadcast. We've got Vito waiting, and I better give him some time. I hope we haven't put you to sleep, Vito, with all this crazy jazz. What can I see? Where are you? Yeah. WA2PJF, if you're still there with us, Vito. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, who is that with the question?
Whiskey Juliet 2 Bravo.
Go right ahead.
Okay, I guess this is for Eric or anybody else that might have some knowledge. I'm just curious. I know it took the U.S., you know, quite a long time to finally switch over to digital TV. I was just curious if anybody out there knew, if anything heard, you know, through the grapevine about FM broadcast and AM broadcast. Is there any talk of when the United States is going to switch over to digital? I know they've come out with HD back, I guess, about 10 years ago. They came out with HD FM and HD AM that gives you a high definition sound on FM by putting sidebands onto each of those signals, and so it gives digital data onto the analog signal. But is there any talk? I've heard Norway was going to switch over to digital FM at some point. I think I heard something about that, but I wonder if anybody heard anything about any plans for the United States to switch their FM or AM analog over to digital. Back over you, Dick, WJTV.
Very fine, Joe. Let's see if Eric is still with us. I bet you he knows. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, he may have gotten to touchdown. So you're allowed to ask that question again next week. I don't know if anyone else on frequency knows. Quite possibly John does. Anybody else know whether or not our FM over-the-air broadcast is going to eventually go digital? Give me a call, letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, on the input frequency, I heard N1KBY. But maybe you don't have the PL turned on. You didn't come through the repeater. You need a 136.5 hertz of PL, 4Z PL. And sometimes people get confused because on this repeater, it has an output PL that's different than the input PL. So some people tune the output PL and think they've got it. So N1KBY, want to give it another try? K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, sorry about that, Dick. N1KBY. As far as the transition to digital goes, I think it's fairly safe to say AM and FM are probably can be considered apples and oranges along those lines. But AM is certainly a whole other conversation. FM, I think I would just say that the receiver and public marketplace will dictate that transition. Once the adoption curve of radios gets up to, pick a number, you know, 70, 80%, something like that, of HD radios in the marketplace, it's going to be very difficult for the industry to transition. But at some point, there'll be an inflection point, and that transition will occur. You know, when that's going to happen, I think, is anybody's guess, but there is no FCC-mandated sunset or hard cutoff. Although, you know, certainly, especially in the case most recently, let me reset. There's been some discussion of that, in favor of that, for AM, but... I hope that gives you some perspective. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, N1KBY.
Very fine, Jeff. Jeff's in Simsbury, I think it is. Simsbury, Connecticut. Simsbury, Connecticut. He's 81 miles from me. What are you using for transmitting antenna? You're coming through to both my input and the repeater input, gangbusters. You've got some altitude, you've got some antenna, you've got some power. And I'm guessing you work in the broadcast industry, Jeff, or you know somebody who does. N1KBY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, I just have a little bit of HAAT advantage. That's really it. I'm running a collinear repeater base station antenna for a ham radio antenna, if you will, and it's... up on a tower, up on a bit of a hill. So, luckily, I can make it into the repeater okay. And yes, I do work in the industry. I work for CBS Radio and maintain some facilities up here in our cluster in Connecticut.
So, I think we've gotten an answer, Joe. But Joe, you've asked the original question, so you've got the opportunity right now of questioning Jeff further if you want to. WJ2B. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, pretty much that's what I thought too. There's no FCC mandate as to the date. You know, nothing been really talked about. The only thing I've heard definite is that Norway was switching over to digital FM and you know, getting rid of their analog FM. But the United States, as far as I know, like you said, I don't think there's any mandates yet. As far as AM, I haven't heard anything about AM either. What you said, there's some kind of thing, something going on with AM maybe, but yeah, I mean, it's really tough because at least with the digital TV people, you know, that had analog-only tuners could buy a converter. With a car radio, in an old car, it's kind of difficult to get, you know, to the antenna connection behind the dashboard and all that to put any kind of converter in there. In a car is asking the person to do a lot of labor to try to convert that digital signal to analog to be able to go into an analog-only radio. So it's kind of asking a lot of those people. So I guess it might still be a while, but I guess at some point the FCC is probably going to mandate and switch over on FM. As I know there's no talk of it yet, so it's pretty much what I've heard also. So very good. Thanks for the info. I appreciate it. WJ2B.
Hey,
sure,
Jack. Go right ahead, Eric.
I was actually going through the tunnel before. I'm just going up the empire here. But as far as like a converter goes, if you look at any of the Sirius or XM satellites, they have little FM transmitters. That's not an issue. As far as IBOP goes, as far as I'm concerned, it's nice on paper, but it's not so nice in reality.
is I bought the Scandinavian system. I didn't quite get the connection. I'm not completely up to speed on this one. Over to you, Eric.
IBOC is a system that we currently use to put digital FM and digital AM on the air, and you happen to have an HD radio, that's what you're picking up.
Very good. Okay. In my opinion, many a ham radio operator loves being in front of a microphone or behind a key, but in front of a microphone. Therefore, to them, the most desirable job in the world would be in broadcast television or radio. So whenever we get off to over-the-air broadcast television or radio, boy, we get a lot of excitement. John and I have, and Paul, we have a slightly loose schedule where we claim most of the time that the first hour from 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock is questions, then we go over to the mailbag. We've only missed that by 2.5 hours tonight, John. Does that mean we're late? KC2WJB, did you RIW the deck, man?
KC2WGB. Well, it could, but after listening to all this, I'm not going to buy a television thing because I don't think it's ready. I'm going to wait for it to be perfected, so I'll just listen to my radio. And let's go over to Paul and get some important information from Paul. I can hold this stuff until next week, no problem at all.
Okay. Let's see if Paul's with us. WS2N, yeah, he's got to be because he signed in earlier. WS2N, what's NASA doing? And I think the answer is 131 astronomical units, the last I heard. My favorite Voyager spacecraft. The QRP rig out there that's really doing a long-range transmission. WS2N with the space report number 148, I think it is, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got a call.
WS2N, 149. I have to count that 1 week that we were tight, like tonight, because about like my record keeping, I just combined one, you know, those 2 weeks. That's why we're still at 149. We didn't lose a week. And John, I'm ready to buy more TVs. You know, I'm about to say this is great. And you're gonna go one way. I'm gonna go the other way. I gotta get more HD TVs. The space report, Dick. Yeah, well, a lot of things going on. You got the there was a Mexican satellite that was supposed to be put up in the air, and this is a you know a 10,000-pound satellite that was gonna be put in geosynchronous orbit by a Proton rocket from Russia. And, you know, the Mexican government spent a couple of billion dollars on these three satellites. This one, and there's another one going to be launched by the United States on an Atlas rocket. A smaller one went up a couple of years ago by Orbital Science. They put it together. And but this one that went up the other day, the third stage blew up on the Russians, so they're having problems. This was the Russian Proton rocket. You know, recently at the end of April, they had the other one gave them a problem with the Progress that was going to go to the International Space Station. That was the Soyuz. So they got problems with that. That's got to be grounded until they straighten that out. And now the Proton rocket apparently had a fault in one of the Venera rockets. You know, the third stage. Well, a Proton rocket has six big engines on the bottom on the first stage, but then it goes up and you get to the final stage, and there's four rockets with these Venera rockets, and that's how they do the steering. They don't have the gimbling effect that you know that for SpaceX uses. So the Venera rocket, you know, they think that gave them a problem and blew, and they wound up not putting the satellite into a geotransfer orbit, which was the plan. And the third stage came down and crashed in Siberia. Blew, you know, burnt up a lot, but pieces did come down. We drop it. So, it's strange because I was going to discuss this particular rocket how they get up there. You know, it's from Baikonur Cosmodrome, which is like 51 degrees in latitude, and yet they get to a geosynchronous orbit. We talk a lot about on the net not being able to, you know, change more than 3 degrees, but they do with the geosynchronous orbit. They get up to it. They put this into a, what they call a geosynchronous transfer orbit, and it gets up to what they do is they send it to a apogee, and at that point, it's basically, theoretically, it's not really moving that much. It's not going up, it's not going down, and they have it very elliptical. You know, you have a very low perigee, and then extremely high apogee. And at that point, they're able to fly the breeze rocket, the final stage. And they do this about 5 different times until they get to a geosynchronous orbit. In this case, well, they were going to go to 20 degrees. So I want to talk about that. Meanwhile, this thing blew up, causing other problems.
Coming.
And, one second, Wesley. Actually, before the proton rocket went up, there's a woman that's supposed to go up, Sarah Brightman, a singer from England. And she paid these, you know, they estimate $50 million put herself on a 10-day trip to the International Space Station. But after the fiasco with the Progress Soyuz last month, she backed out. And, she's saying because of family problems. But naturally, people are wondering, you know, maybe because of the Soyuz problem. Now the proton rocket, you know, the Russians are in tough shape right now, and that's more of a reason why the United States should continue to fund and not only the NASA, SLS program, the Space Launch System program, and Orion, but fund and support the commercial industry even more than ever. We're going to be putting astronauts into space with our own rockets by private companies. I know I'm running out of time, so I'm going to turn it over to you, Dick. Some other things to cover. One particular launch coming up before I drop it is on May 20th. Let me drop it. And that's the X-37B, I think called space plane, and that's the one that looks like the shuttle by the military, the Air Force really funds this thing, and it's going up on an Atlas rocket on Wednesday. We'll see how that thing does. It's the fairing is completely all the way around it, so you can't see the wings or anything. Protects it from the atmosphere, and then they get above the atmosphere, the fairings come off, and the space plane comes out and goes on its own probably for a couple of years. It'll be up to at least a year and a half. Dick, K2RIW, tag map, this is WS2N for the space portion, part of that mess.
Now, we've got some more time, Paul, but Wes wants to make a comment. Into X-ray-N, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, it was unfortunate. A proton bracket was used for the past 4 years and was performing with changeable luck. Uncertainty, it became more prevalent when Russia went to the province with Ukraine. They were trying to push in so many areas, and the pressure on the space program was became extremely political. So at that point, people in Baikonur and plenty of other places were rather trying to not disappoint the chief and commander and the czar. We had a similar situation in the United States where political pressure created the grief. I'm not going to go to it. The proton was carrying on a special purpose satellite was made for Mexicans. We assume, if you say, I assume that was a spy satellite, whatever. And this actually didn't happen. May 9th, there was a big ceremony in Moscow, and that was 70 years of Russia winning the Second World War. So the start of Proton was kind of a prestigious one, and that political push was extremely evident over there. So maybe Russians were like, oh, we gotta speed up and we have to do it. Unfortunately, at May 8, Proton went down, and the Russians say it was burned up in air. So those are unfortunate about the Proton. Another news from today, Great Britain decided to stop cooperating with Russia and never use Proton M or any Russian engines for their satellites or their space missions. And to actually get back to you.
Wesley, and did you see how big this thing was? My goodness. The satellite was going to open up to 41 meters by 30 meters. Big thing. Dick, over to you.
My goodness, that sounds large. Wes, I haven't been getting any emails from you for a couple of weeks lately. I'm not a computer maven. My son is the computer, the net control person. No, that's not the right word, but you know what I mean. The computer maven in the house. We got a whole bunch of computers all networked together, and he's made some extremely sturdy firewall system. He's really concerned about whether or not we get spam or viruses or whatever. So something has changed in the address of the emails you try to mail to me. I haven't done anything to reject your emails. Something has changed with the address, and when he comes back home again, I'm going to have him look into what it is. There's something about your address that our firewall says, no, I'm not going to accept that. And I think I've heard you say that you've been getting bounces from me. Is that true, Wes? Over to you, KQLAW.
Yes, it is, and I stopped to send emails to you because of that. Had about 7 bounces.
Then that's something active that I've done. It's something that in the past we've had this happen with other people, and we eventually found out that something was not quite proper with the address. Therefore, our crazy firewall system thinks it's a virus, or think it's improper in some way and won't accept it. So when my son comes home in a couple days, I'll have him look into that. One of the things you should know, Paul, is that when you look at the Sunday issue of New York Times book review section, there's a new book that's come out about Elon Musk. And as you read that one-page description of the book and him, boy, he is something else. I think he's 46 years old, a multimillionaire, if not a billion. I think he's a multimillionaire. And he's done a number of high-risk things with both his space business and his car business. And he sounds like he's positive he's going to put astronauts on Mars. You know that I'm a little bit skeptical about that one. So if you get the New York Times, look at the book section. You're going to find out a lot about Elon Musk. And so you've got 6 minutes. You could give us some more space if you wanted to, Paul. WS2N, KQLAW, the TechNet.
Understood, Dick. Well, yeah, he wants to do it in 2026, 10 years before the before NASA wants to do it, and he's going to do it. He wants to do it with not only the Falcon 9 Heavy that's coming up at the end, probably in the fall they'll launch that thing. That's 3 Falcon 9s bolted together. A lot of people think, well, he wants to do that with, you know, originally he'll get to Mars with that. He might even put people into orbit. But he's got a bigger rocket plan. They don't have a name for the rocket yet, but the engines are called Raptor engines. And it dwarfs the Falcon 9. It's an incredible, it's got 9 engines, similar to the Falcon 9, but probably 3 times bigger in diameter, probably like, instead of 12 feet in diameter, it's like 33 feet in diameter at the base. He's got big plans in the future. Multi-billionaire. He started off, one of the guys involved with PayPal, and then they sold that out, and he's been rolling the dice ever since. He's involved with Tesla Water. Let me drop it. And of course, he's involved with the Solar City. I don't know if you see that, those installations going around. I've seen them on the island. Solar City, that's his as well. All the solar panels on a roof. So, quite a character. Comes out of South Africa, but he's Americanized. And he's got big plans. Eventually, he'd like to go to Mars himself. So, it's his ultimate goal. Now, he just got certified just yesterday, where they're going to allow a lot of NASA flights to go up. He's going to be allowed to put more NASA scientific missions up, including now one that, he's going to do one this fall called Jason 3. That's 800 miles above the planet. Going to look down on the ocean. Don't launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And then because of this certification he's got, he's going to be allowed now to do tests. Tests is the one that's going to be like a Kepler. It's going to almost go out to the moon and around the Earth. It's going to be highly elongated orbit. And that's going to look for planets. So he's gonna get that contract and many more. He's got a lot on his manifest. I think it's something like 40 flights in the next 2 years or something that he's supposed to do for foreign countries. Quite a character. So we'll see how space exploration technology. That's really the official name. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, he's a real go-getter. People sometimes call him the Steve Jobs of the space world. He works 100-hour weeks, and he's a real straw boss. He drives his people very hard. He drives himself very hard. So for years on end, if I understand correctly, he works 100-hour weeks. So you can get New York Times in your book review section. And I'm not sure if it's a biography or an autobiography, but a significant book about him, and it looks like he's going to, assuming he stays healthy, it looks like he's going to really accomplish things, and he doesn't worry about a big challenge. Okay, we've only got a minute left. You guys have just heard TechNet number 1,556, yes, 1,556 of the series that began back in 1972. We got on the subject of broadcast tonight, and boy, that's a subject that just draws us in something fierce. Be kind to each other. We'll be back next week, and maybe we'll get serious about broadcast. Hey, John, KC2WGB, what great question did we miss tonight on the mailbag? You got it, John,
KQLAW. KC2WGB. Well, one was interesting concerning a spectrum analyzer that someone's looking for help in a problem he's troubleshooting with his antenna. We'll cover that next week. It sounds interesting, and I think you'll be able to run with that. But I'd like to thank everybody, as usual, for joining the net, and great questions tonight. A lot of action. Well, she'll return next week. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Satellite that they attached Apogee kick motor to successfully, and this wasn't working, and they did this all in orbit. Sometimes we have a couple extra minutes. I thought I'd just throw that in there. That kind of, it was something we talked about maybe 10 years ago. And sure enough, they have a picture of it and a story about it. All the records that they broke on that flight. Back to you, Dick, and then I guess John.
Yeah, you guys doubled. John came through. We heard the last third of your message. You might want to repeat the first third, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, sorry, John. I thought I got in there before you. Hey, there's years ago, maybe 10 years or more ago, we talked about three astronauts doing an EVA at the same time on the back of a shuttle, working on a satellite. And sure enough, they have a picture of that on the NASA site. And they're talking about all the records that particular flight broke. So they showed the three astronauts out there. And they attached an Apogee kick motor onto it because it wasn't working. And they sent it off, and sure enough, it put itself into a geosynchronous orbit, I guess it was. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you didn't re-mention that. I think there was an Indian satellite where the Apogee kick motor failed. Shuttle went up there and reinstalled, I think, another Apogee kick motor. I think that was the geosynchronous satellite from India, if I remember correctly. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
That was the Intelsat, they called it satellite. That was the one. It was unusable. And they launched it on a Titan vehicle in March 1990, and the shuttle went up there a couple of years later because it was just floating around, and they put this, perigee kick motor attached to it so they could get it to a higher orbit. Back to you.
Okay, the solid-state engine that kicks you from parking orbit up to geosynchronous orbit, I think they call that the Apogee kick motor, Paul. And, you want to say something about
that? Somebody else.
Okay. Yeah, so that's the Apogee kick motor that I think they get you up there. And I think it takes two burns to get you from a circular parking orbit up to the geosynchronous orbit and circularize it. The Holloman maneuver, I think it's called. Takes two burns to get to both the right altitude and to circularize the orbit. Two separate burns, 180 degrees on opposite sides of the orbit is the way that's usually done. So three astronauts out there to do that procedure. And there was talk from time to time of rescuing satellites, bringing them back down. There was even talk of rescuing the Hubble Space Telescope and bringing it back down. And boy, you don't want to do that. Because all of that energy you spent with all of that rocket power to get that heavy object up there, you're going to take all of that energy back out as thermal heating of your tiles when you re-enter the atmosphere with all that extra mass. So you really don't want to do that. It doubles your chances of getting a failure somewhat like that they had with the Columbia. Okay, bye-bye, you guys. We'll be back next week. And save up your good questions. Particularly on broadcast. Bye-bye, you all. K2RAW clear.
That's
the
way out, Dick, if you have a moment.
It's the Perigee kick motor, and they use the Apogee motor. After a transfer orbit, then they use the Apogee motor to change inclination and putting it into a geostationary orbit at the same time. They combine those rocket, they'll do two or three of them usually to do that. Back to you, Dick, and I hear Rich.
Yeah, I also heard Mike number two. I think I heard Mike number two. Is that true, Mike?
Actually, it was Jeff up here in Connecticut, N1KBY.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, no, I was wondering if I had something I wanted to connect with you one-on-one about. I think you'd get a real kick out of, but it's not something appropriate for the net. Do you have an email or some obscure frequency you might hang out on? Over.
Okay. My email is my call letters at arrl.net is the easiest one. I'm a life member of ARRL. And let's see. An obscure frequency. I guess we could go to...
That's all right. I'll shoot you an email.
Roger, Dodger. And can you give me a hint? Is it a subject that's going to get you and me rich quick in a hurry?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Oh, well, I can dream. And is it a blue sky project?